Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, as we begin today with the former United States Defense Secretary, William Cohen. As some of you remember, Cohen ran the military during President Clinton's second term, 1997 to 2001. He had been a Republican senator from Maine. Before that, he has a consulting business today and travels worldwide. William Cohen is here today because he has a new novel with the cheery premise that an American city has been hit by a nuclear attack. Thousands are dead, and the government is trying to figure out if it was done by Iran. It must be the kind of thing defense secretaries have nightmares about, so why not write the nightmare into a novel, maybe? But we'll talk about defense issues, real as well as imagined, including the recent revelations about the real-life Iranian nuclear program, perhaps, and more, with former defense secretary William Cohen. The book is his second nuclear war novel. It's called Blink of an Eye. Secretary Cohen, thanks for coming in. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to be here, and I'm not sure I agree with your description of the novel being cheery, but it's certainly a serious.
That was cheery in quotes. How would you describe it?
A serious and hopefully thought-provoking story about the dangers we face as far as nuclear proliferation, with more countries seeking to gain access to nuclear weaponry. It does eventually present a problem that perhaps we won't be able to prevent. So I wanted to deal with an issue that I did stay awake many nights, and when people would ask me, what do you lie awake thinking about and worried about at nighttime, it was always the threat of a nuclear bomb going off in American City, and that's what I wrote about here.
So you woke up sweating from an Armageddon dream one night in maybe 1999, and you said, boy, that was a doozy. It would make a great thriller someday.
Well, it allows me to continue to write. I've been writing since my college days. This is my 12th book, my fifth novel. But it allows me to take my life's experiences and to blend them into a story that perhaps might have a wider readership than if it were just a straight nonfiction book. There have been some brilliant books written about nuclear terrorism. Graham Allison, I think, is the father of those, and there are many others. And so I wanted to put it beyond the reach of beyond the realm, I should say, of the academic world or those who are focused on national security and get it into the more popular mind.
And your previous novel, Dragonfire, was a bestseller on the New York Times list. So the idea here is not just to tell a good yarn, but also to try to educate people about some of the issues facing the military or facing the country?
Well, the first scene, for example, is a replication of what happened during my watch at the Pentagon when the USS Cole was hit by a terrorist attack. And this book opens up with all of our troops being pulled out of Iraq and the last load of soldiers being put aboard a small boat taken to a larger ship. Transport ship is it's hit by a similar attack coming from a bomb-laden boat being driven by a couple of, quote, terrorists. And that's the opening scene because it had such an impact on me when I was at the Pentagon in terms of how could this have happened, how did we let it happen. But then it leads to the second stage, and that is the president is sitting down hosting a dinner for the Israeli prime minister, and he is told during the course of a dinner something terrible has happened on the coast, southeast coast of the United States. They're not sure what it is, but the entire area has been darkened and blackened out, no communications, and the president feels compelled to say something about it because, as we know, we've seen presidents who have hesitated. When President Bush was sitting in a classroom, 9/11 took place, he was criticized for not responding sooner. We had a similar situation take place with Katrina. Under President Obama, there was some delay in terms of responding, perhaps to BP, the oil spill. So there's pressure on a president to show that we're in control. I've got as an incident, there's been harm done, but we're on the way. And as usual, first reports tend to be wrong. And in this particular case, it's not a tsunami as they first report, but a nuclear bomb. And then the question becomes for him, how do we get relief to the people who have been harmed? How do we contain the spread of fear? Because there'll be copycat calls coming in where people will be threatening, saying we have at least 10 more of these bombs that are going to go off unless you do the following. And then how do you know what happened? How could it have happened? Who did it? And what do you do about it? All in an election year when the pressure is on the president to take action.
You and President Clinton were criticized in real life for not having done enough in response to the Cole attack, and that may have set the stage to some degree, maybe because al-Qaeda was not weakened militarily after that, for 9/11.
Well, the first issue was who did it. Was it a local group? Was it al-Qaeda? And the fact was we didn't know at the time. We asked the CIA who was responsible. They said we can't pin the responsibility. We had a choice then. Do we just simply launch an attack into Afghanistan and wipe out a city in Afghanistan in response? So, and plus it was right on the edge of the election, and it would have been charged that we were responding for, you know, wag the dog type
right.
of situation.
To help get Gore elected president.
It wasn't determined until the following January in terms of who actually was behind the attack. But that's also something I tried to capture in this novel, Blink of an Eye, in terms of the suspicion that someone did this and the president is under pressure to attack and to retaliate, when in fact they may not have been involved at all. So that was part of the rationale for this novel.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen, he served in the second Clinton term. His new novel is called Blink of an Eye, and we can open up the phones. Anything you always wanted to ask a Secretary of Defense of the United States but didn't have one around to ask, now's your chance. And seriously, we can talk about current defense questions. We can talk about things that happened on his watch during the Clinton administration, or you can ask him about novel writing about nuclear war. 212-433-WNYC for William Cohen this morning, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or a question to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. In the novel, and I ask you this for a real-life reason, does the U.S. contemplate a retaliatory nuclear strike against Iran or whatever country they suspect may have dropped a nuke on the United States?
I think if the United States ever were attacked by a state actor, in other words, another country, the pressure upon the United States to respond would be overwhelming. The question would be what sort of weapons would be used. Depending upon the nature of the country that launched the attack, it could range anywhere from conventional to nuclear, yes.
Because I guess I have a hard time figuring out why we would keep a retaliatory nuclear strike as an option in the modern era, even if we assume Hiroshima and Nagasaki were justified because it saved so many troops when there were battlefronts all over Asia at the end of World War II. We aren't likely to have that kind of massive deployment today. So nuclear arms become, you know, in the worst telling of it, weapons to be used against populations, against cities, against people, and that would just be terrorism. Under what circumstances would it ever be justifiable for the United States to drop a nuclear bomb?
Well, if you had a country that had multiple nuclear bombs and one had just been launched against you with a threat that others may be forthcoming, then you certainly would go against those targets. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we have a so-called triad, to make sure that any potential enemy doesn't think they can take out your nuclear weapons, so that preventing a response from you. So it gets into strategic deterrence. There is that aspect of mutual assured destruction.
Mutual assured destruction. So the idea is that it could deter another country by, in effect, wiping
right.
out one of their cities
right.
rather than trying to go after wherever the nuclear arms are actually kept.
No, actually, you would try to take out the where they're kept to make sure they can't fire
but
anymore.
But that's a conventional attack.
Well, it depends how deeply buried they are. You might not be able to get down deep enough to take them out. But this is another aspect of the novel. What I am trying to do is to raise the level of consciousness, saying these are not just another weapon, another arrow in our quiver. These are totally destructive weapons, and we need to get the numbers down as low as we possibly can, and I believe eventually it's a goal that's way in the distance, but to eliminate them from the planet. I know this sounds terribly idealistic, but then Ronald Reagan had that dream as well. And there are many arms control advocates and those who are specialists in the field who think this is just, quote, pie in the sky thinking that you'll always have a need for nuclear weapons. But my goal is to say we've got too many of them. We need to get rid of as many as we can, and we need to discourage and deter other countries from getting them, which gets us to Iran.
Right. Zev in the Bronx. You're on WNYC with former Defense Secretary William Cohen. Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Okay.
So sorry to change the subject a little bit, but you did say any subject. Back in the late 90s, 98, I was walking with a guy whose son was flying the U-2. The Clinton bombed Iraq right in the middle of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and the joke on the street was that he did it to distract opinions. I always wondered, what do you think? Do you really believe that he bombed Iraq because he really wanted to bomb them, or was it really a political ploy?
See, you said the wag the dog charge
right.
will always come up.
Sure.
There it is.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you have a little time. I want to explain exactly what happened, because that was the charge, and it was totally false. I had a major role to play in that decision. And if you go back historically, you will find that actually it was about a month and a half before that attack was launched in December that we actually had planned to take out some of Saddam's weapons sites. And we had made a determination after he had thrown out the inspectors that we were going to take military action. I, in fact, had traveled to 11 different countries in 3 days in order to prepare these countries, saying this is what's going to happen. At the very last moment, while planes were actually starting to lift off and take action against Iraq, Saddam Hussein sent a signal that he was willing to have the inspectors come back in. So President Clinton called off the attack at that time. And at that time, we decided that in the future, if he doesn't comply this time, we won't wait 72 hours. We'll be ready to go at a moment's notice. And at that time, there was a man, an Ambassador Butler, who was sent to Iraq, who had a 2-week period in which he was going to make an examination as to whether or not Saddam seriously was going to comply. And that was going to start on December 1 and run for 2 weeks, roughly, to December, let's say, 14 or 15. At that time, I expected Saddam to comply, let's say 50%, 60%, do something to show that he was willing to comply with the UN Security Council resolutions. The butler went over, did his inspection. He called back 2 weeks later, and the report was not good. He's not complying at all. So President Clinton was actually in the state of Israel at that time, and he had to fly back to Washington. We met upon his arrival. We said the agreement was if he didn't comply, we were going to take out his sites. So President Clinton gave it was my recommendation. It was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs' recommendation. It had absolutely zero to do with Monica Lewinsky. However, because of the timing, and again, President Clinton said, look, I'm not going to play any games with this. We're going to do what's right under the circumstances. Unfortunately, the timing was such that the impeachment resolution was being considered by the House Judiciary Committee. And I had a call from former Speaker Gingrich and others to say that the place is on fire up in the House. They feel that this was politically motivated. And I asked what they wanted me to do. They said, come up and talk to us through a joint session tonight. I went to the Hill. I was there for almost 3 hours in a joint session. I laid out exactly what had taken place, why it had taken place, and got the chairman, myself, had a standing ovation that night, saying this was the real reason it took place on that eve.
It's funny to think of Republicans just a few years before the Iraq war being so skeptical about whether military action was needed against Saddam Hussein for resisting weapons inspections. But with your experience then, skirmishing with Saddam really on and off all those years, the little violations that they kept engaging in of the no-fly zone,
right,
as well as this larger narrative that you just told, when President Bush proposed going to overthrow Saddam, were you convinced that Saddam had nuclear weapons or other WMDs?
Two separate questions. Number one, I assumed, as did most in the government, that he had nuclear weapons or, let's say, weapons of mass destruction. because he had used them in the past, had refused to account for them. So there was an assumption that he had weapons of mass destruction. However, we were also of the opinion that Saddam had been so weakened by the imposition of the sanctions and by the fact that you just mentioned he had systematically over the years kept firing missiles at our planes. We had almost totally eliminated his air defense systems. He had really nothing much left. By the time I was out of office, there was not much that Saddam could do. We had the no-fly zones in the north and the south, and he had very little, if any, air defense system left. So I did not feel he presented a threat to the United States or to anyone else at that time.
Former Defense Secretary William Cohen, his new novel is called Blink of an Eye. We'll continue in a minute. We'll take more of your phone calls with anything you want to ask a former Defense Secretary of the United States about then or now. And I will ask you next about what might happen to the Pentagon if the Super Committee fails to come to a deal on the debt by their deadline in a week. And the biggest cuts would be to the Pentagon if the automatic triggers have to go into effect instead. So we continue with William Cohen in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen. You may remember he served for the second term of the Clinton administration, 1997 to 2001. Basically, he has a new novel. It's a realistic nuclear war scenario with a national security advisor as the main protagonist called Blink of an Eye. And we'll continue with your phone calls for Secretary Cohen. All our lines are full. You can also post comments or questions to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. But 1 week from today is the deadline for the so-called Congressional Super Committee to come up with a 10-year deficit reduction plan, or big automatic cuts would take effect, especially to the military, which I think would be cut by about $54 billion a year, or about half of the automatic trigger cuts that would take effect. What do you think this so-called sequestration budget, the triggers, would mean for our national defense? Is this making you nervous?
It would change certainly the national security structure of the United States. I think the real issue is, do we need to reduce the defense budget? The answer is yes. We have to participate like other departments in this effort to get our fiscal house in order. The real issue for me is, what do you want the United States to do? What role should we play in this ever more turbulent world of ours? We can certainly reduce the size of the budget. We can start just having a smaller military. The quickest way to save money is just to release people, fire people as such. And so you can get the money savings the quickest by just getting people off the payroll, so to speak, and have more and more of our military turn to the private sector. That will increase unemployment almost immediately and dramatically.
So you're not recommending that option?
Well, that's one of the options you have to face up to. We're going to have a smaller military. We are going to be forced to do less with less. That's just the reality of the world in which we're living. And so we have to decide, what is our role to be? Are we going to cede the stabilizing role that we play in the world today? Is that something that's going to produce prosperity? I've always felt that we are a force for good in the world, and we're a force for stability. And when you have stability, you allow countries to actually prosper. We share in that prosperity. To the extent that there is instability, well, they say capital is a coward. It takes flight immediately when there's any sign of instability. So on the one hand, you can say we can start reducing the size of our force. Number two, we can start eliminating weapon systems. Well, that means you're going to lay off people who are making those systems, and every contractor and subcontractor below them to the hardware store, who may be making bolts and nuts that go on one of our aircraft or one of our ships. So it would filter into the system very quickly and have a dramatic impact upon the unemployment rate, I think, would skyrocket. Not to mention, what role would we be playing either in the Middle East or now in the Pacific? And the President of the United States, President Obama, has said we want to be seriously engaged in promoting activity in the Asia-Pacific region, because we've got an emerging power called China that is starting to at least throw its weight around, economic weight, and soon to be, I would expect, some military power as well.
Well, how much would these automatic trigger cuts really, degrade our ability to do that? For example, on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org, we have a piece up just this morning, pulling the triggers. What would missing the deadline look like? And there's a graphic up there regarding the military that says the defense budget would face cuts of $54 billion. That's in the first year, 2013, or the equivalent of 14 Arleigh Burke-class destroyers, 12 Virginia-class submarines, 12 F-35 Joint Strike Fighters. There's also a piece on global security that says, let's see, now I'm going to have to find that piece, but it, oh, there it is. It says, if triggered, the automatic sequestration would lower U.S. defense spending by 23% in 2013 and could result in the country's Minuteman III ICBMs being phased out, leaving aircraft and submarine-launched ballistic missiles as the country's only available means of carrying out a nuclear strike, quoting Defense Secretary Panetta. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know what these scenarios mean in real life, and I'm sure there are a lot of people listening in the New York area who say, come on, people need jobs, people need education, everything is being squeezed. We don't need all this defense spending. Maybe this is a good thing.
Well, again, you have to decide what does the world look like today, tomorrow, and what do we think the likely threats are going to be in the future? I did go through something called the QDR, the Quadrennial Defense Review. Every 4 years, you have to make an assessment. What are the threats out there? And can we identify them that are 10 and 15 years out in the future? And then how do we contend with those threats? What sort of systems do we need to take them on? Now, when Bob Gates was Secretary of Defense in his final year, before his final year, he started to talk about we need to get systems that are not quite as sophisticated, that may be only 75% as sophisticated as the best of the best, but that you'll get them on time and within a budget, because we have seen explosive growth in the cost of these systems because they're more and more sophisticated. So there are ways in which we can trim the defense budget, but you should do it in a systematic way, saying, let's understand what it is we're trying to build a national security structure, mm-hmm. a defense structure against what type of threats. What you have to do that before you can start saying, I'm going to cut 30 F-35s, or I'm going to cut so many frigates, I'm going to cut so many destroyers. What's your role in the world? What do you see as your role?
Alex in Westchester has a specific kind of cut to recommend, I think. Alex, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good. Hi, how are you?
Good.
The Cold War is over. The Soviet Union does not exist, and Russia is not a threat to attack Western Europe. Would it be feasible to pull all of our military out of Germany without having an effect on national security?
I think you can certainly reduce forces in Europe, but there is an interesting question. Should we be shifting some of our forces to the Pacific, which is where most of the economic activity, or at least 50% of the activity, is going to take place, where you're now starting to see issues being raised by countries like Vietnam, we remember Vietnam, asking for the United States' help in dealing with China.
You're anticipating this. This is not happening, Vietnam, or it is happening already?
This is happening already. Vietnam has requested the United States to help resolve the challenge posed by China over certain islands that are also claimed by the Philippines and other countries in the Asia-Pacific region. I just co-authored a study with Mr. Hank Greenberg for the Center for Strategic International Studies at the request of the State Department as what our relationship should be with the so-called ASEAN countries, the Association of Southeast Asian Countries, who are doing very well, by the way, in their trade relationship with China. But they're concerned they don't want to be dictated to by China. And China, of course, is a new economic power, certainly in the Pacific. It may be an economic global power as well.
But you're saying China poses such a military threat in a way that would impact the safety or the standard of living in the United States that we should take, let's say, all those troops that we don't need in Germany anymore, and rather than reduce the size of the military payroll, move them to Asia? Why wouldn't China just find that provocative?
Well, not take all of them, move them, but building relationships with countries who fear the power of China. For example, we're going to strengthen our relationship with Australia, who has been with us in every conflict we've ever had.
That's in the news this morning, President Obama talking about it.
Absolutely. And we're going to strengthen our relationship with India, hopefully. It's starting to materialize.
Military
now.
Relationship.
And commercial. India has to modernize its forces. It's now looking for the kinds of equipment that will protect its national security. We have to help Japan rebuild its security as well. And we want better relationship with China. I spend a lot of time in China. I've been going there since 1978. And so I want to see better relations with China. But you also want to encourage China to take this massive power that they're building and integrate it into the international community in a positive and non-threatening way. So,
following up on China, Robert in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian, and good morning, both of you. Mr. Secretary, hello.
Hello.
I have three questions for you, sir.
Okay.
What is the goal of this unprecedented military buildup that China's been engaging in for the last few years, number one? Number two, do you think that they will grab Taiwan? And number three, if they do, what do you think the United States should do about it?
All great questions. You could fold it into one, and that is the nature of the relationship that we have with China going forward. First of all, as I mentioned, China's economic power is growing rather significantly. They have something like $3 trillion in foreign reserves. Excuse me. They're going to grow in military power as well. That's just inevitable, and we'll have to understand that's the way of the world. When you have that kind of economic power, when you have resources that you are dependent upon spread throughout the world, you're going to want to make sure you can defend access to those resources. So I think we have to anticipate they're going to get stronger and bigger. They're certainly developing stealth technology on their fighter aircraft. I guess that technology must have come from the United States.
But to Robert's first question, to what end in the case of China? What would they go after militarily that would threaten Vietnam or the Philippines or Australia? Why would they care to go and seize land if that's what we're talking about?
I think it's not so much. When you build a base of power that looks overwhelming, then you don't have to use the power. You're a giant and you can squash anyone who wants to contest you. For example, there is a great controversy over the South China Sea now. China has declared all of the South China Sea is theirs, with all of the resources, basically. Now, we take a quite different position, as does the international community. And I think China is interested in pushing us further and further out from their shores, so to speak, where we have surveillance that takes place in terms of, what are you doing? We need to know. We want you to be more transparent. What are your activities? Are they peaceful? Are they more aggressive? What is your design on Taiwan? We have taken the position with China, and they find this troubling. But we have a one-China policy announced ever since the days of Richard Nixon, a one-China policy, and yet we also have signed on to the Taiwan Relations Act, which means that we will provide support for the defense of Taiwan. And they say, how can you have this one-China policy when Taiwan is really part of China? And they've had difficulty accepting our explanation. And what we have said is, one-China policy, we would like to see a reunification under peaceful terms, not under aggression. I think China is building up its military power to say to the United States, don't ever think about intervening if we decide to take action against Taiwan, that we will have such power that it'll be a loser for you. So therefore, just by virtue of the power that is visible, it would discourage you from coming to its assistance.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen, his new book called Blink of an Eye. Looking back, did you manage to be Defense Secretary for 4 years without deploying any ground troops? I was thinking about that today, thinking that you had the no-fly zone enforcement with Iraq, the bombings in Afghanistan and Sudan after al-Qaeda attacked our embassies, and the Kosovo intervention, which is perhaps the only war the U.S. ever won with air power alone.
Right.
Am I forgetting anything, ground troops-wise?
No. Listen, I took the position. There was a book that was written by Richard Haass, who was then formerly with the State Department, now with the Council on Foreign Relations. His book was called The Reluctant Sheriff, that's how I saw my role, or the Defense Department's role, being a reluctant sheriff. I looked at the brilliant young men and women who were serving our military, and I get goosebumps even talking about them, how dedicated they are, patriotic, sacrificing, and high energy, and to see what they do day in and day out to defend this country. I treated them all as my sons and daughters. And I didn't want to put them in any jeopardy unless I was willing to put my own sons in that kind of jeopardy. And so I was very reluctant to commit them to war, and did so under the most restrictive circumstances that I could. And that's the reason why we had a 78-day air campaign. I was not going to put them on the ground unless I absolutely had to, and we didn't have to, fortunately. So I think that being a reluctant sheriff is a good role.
We have a few minutes left. Let me ask you about a couple of political things. You were a Republican senator from Maine.
Right.
Both Susan Collins and Olympia Snow worked for you, I believe, right, before running for Senate themselves.
Right.
They are sort of the last bastions of Republican moderation. What do you think of your party these days?
I think what's taking place in both parties is that we're driving people who help make government work out of politics. If you take a Bob Bennett, Senator Bennett from Utah, one of the more conservative members that I enjoyed working with, strong, strong conservative, but he was seen as being too willing to work with Democrats. If you look what is taking place, they're hollowing
out. He got primaried and defeated by a more right-wing candidate.
Exactly. And any Republican candidate who is seen as being willing to work across party lines seems to be getting punished for it. I would say we're developing a parliamentary-type system without having a parliamentary system. Namely, you've got Republicans on the right and Democrats on the left, and neither party is willing to try to come together to say we have to have a consensus in this government of ours, and if we don't, then you're going to have stagnation, paralysis, which we're witnessing today. So it's discouraging to me to see there's not been a greater willingness to reach across the aisle, find compromise. That word compromise has been poll-tested, and it's a sign of, quote, weakness and lack of integrity. So they come up with a different word. We'll search for common ground. Okay, I'll take it. But let's find common ground. If you can't call it compromise, find common ground so that we can get this country moving again with people willing to join hands and say, okay, it's not everything I want, but it's much of what I want.
Did I read you were best man at John McCain's wedding?
I was.
Did you vote for him or Obama?
Well, I voted for the best man.
Okay. So trying to be nonpartisan in your post-political life.
Right.
So you don't have a candidate in the Republican primaries?
At this point, I don't. I'm looking at all the candidates. I'm somewhat discouraged by what I see taking place in terms of the level of the debate. Hopefully, as it starts to wend its way to its conclusion, we'll start to see a focus in a much more, acute form of analysis and what needs to be done rather than simply planting a flag and saying under no circumstances. I mean, I think there's going to have to be some kind of a deal put together. It's going to require revenue increases, some tax increases, call it a revenue enhancement, call it what you will, and we're going to have to deal with the entitlements, and there has to be a compromise reached. Otherwise, again, we're going to see nothing but paralysis.
You sound like President Obama, who keeps saying he's the moderate today. The Democrats want compromise, the C word, on the deficit, including, 3-1 spending cuts to tax increases. And he says the Republicans only want the spending cuts, so they're the ones with pure ideology. It's the Democrats who are proposing common ground, and it's being rejected. Do you agree with that?
I thought the president missed a unique opportunity when the Bowles-Simpson report first came out. He basically walked away from it. And I think we're going to have to come back to it. It's a year later and maybe more difficult now, but I think there is no real option other than the approach taken by Bowles.
You think he walked away from it because there were too many politically difficult things for Democrats, like entitlement cuts and that?
I think obviously the Democrats were enraged by his willingness to talk about that, and Republicans weren't willing to talk about tax increases. So I think if you don't have some kind of a formulation, I mean, I thought if you get a 3-1 formulation, that's a pretty good deal.
You were controversial after leaving office because you took a job where you were basically lobbying Congress almost immediately after leaving the Pentagon. Washington Post had written up something at the time.
Absolutely wrong. I, in fact, have not lobbied Capitol Hill. I've only been to Capitol Hill and talked to members of Congress maybe on two occasions in 10 years and at their invitation. So that Post article was wrong and say I lobbied Capitol Hill. I have not placed a call to anybody on the Hill.
Directly, indirectly, I don't know how we're parsing words here, joined a firm that was lobbying.
It's my firm. I mean, I created the firm. And so I make sure, since I was the co-author of the reform in terms of making sure the Lobby Disclosure Act, Carl Levin and I were the ones who wrote that law. I want to make sure, even if a single phone call is made to Capitol Hill, I want anybody in my firm to register as a lobbyist. I am not a registered lobbyist, but I want to make sure if anybody in my firm does, even though it doesn't require it, I make them register anyway. And you can look at the disclosure forms. You'll see that there's very little that my firm does on Capitol Hill.
As a moderate, what do you think of the Tea Party movement, and what do you think of Occupy?
The Tea Party movement, I think the Tea Party really was helpful in the sense of expressing rage against the spending habits of this country. I think they did focus attention on something that we have neglected. We as Republicans have failed to measure up to our own ideology, namely, you know, balanced budgets, fiscal concerns. So I think they did a favor in that sense. I don't agree with their social policies at all. I think they've driven the party too far to the right. And I think as a result of that, the independents, which have gone to the Republicans, the last are going to start coming back to the Democrats.
Occupy Wall Street?
I think it's a legitimate expression of outrage on the disparities that exist. And I think that I'm not sure how deep the roots are to the expression, but you can't have the kind of disparities that we have in wealth today with so many millions of people losing their jobs, so many middle-class people now being forced into the poverty levels with very little hope for the future and not have expressions, whether you call it Occupy Wall Street or Occupy whatever, you're going to have the expression of rage because their future is disappearing.
Do we need a centrist third party in this country?
I think we need a centrist philosophy. Say, look, you can be passionate and you have partisan politics that have always existed, but at the end of the day, you have to be willing to reach across the aisle. You have to have a Bob Dole and a George Mitchell or the Senator Baker and others, Tip O'Neill, who could work with Ronald Reagan. You've got to have a willingness on the part of our leadership to say, you know, we've got to make this work.
Former U.S. Defense Secretary William Cohen, his new novel, Blink of an Eye. Thank you very much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Up next, Physics on the Fringe. Stay tuned.